Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm joined by Dr. Joseph Farrell and John Rappaport, and we're going to be talking about how to live a free and inspired life. In fact, we're going to be talking about an event we're doing together in November to ask that same question. The history of this is that we spoke together in San Mateo. It was a very impactful experience, I think, for everybody involved. And the audience and we came out with many more questions we wanted to drill down in the face of what's going on in the planet. What do we do and how do we make sure, as somebody in the audience said, Salieri Report subscriber, how do we break away? And so that's what we're here to talk about today, and we'll be talking about November. So John and Joseph, welcome to the Salieri Report. And if we could just begin with, and I'll start with you, Joseph, tell us a little bit about what happened in San Mateo and why it's led to this discussion that we're having today.
Well, one of the things that I experienced there was we definitely, I think, set a new standard for conferences. There was a very elevated tone of discourse, both from the speakers, but much more importantly from the people that attended. I was literally stunned after my own individual talks. I usually went outside to catch a breath of fresh air and was literally mobbed by people shooting questions at me and talking and sharing comments and so on. At one point, I think I had about, sitting out there at the picnic tables, had about 60 people all kind of standing in a semicircle. And we were all just kind of carrying on this conversation. Everybody that I contacted that way had the sense that something had to be done. And this was a consistent theme of their remarks. What do we do? How do we manage to live our lives? But more importantly, how do we make some sort of impact on the society around us, the culture around us? And more importantly, how do we, to some extent, create a kind of inertia to resist some of the changes that we don't think are terribly healthy within society? And this was a consistent theme, at least in the conversations I had with everybody. So I think we created kind of a critical mass. We raised the bar for what conferences should be and should do, but it also became quite apparent that people were wanting some mechanism, some way to be able to get together, not necessarily in a conference atmosphere, but to get together and brainstorm and share ideas with each other. And I think that's kind of what we started with the ball on this workshop.
It's one of the best things I thought that happened was, rather than overwhelm them with more information about the breakaway civilization, John, you took a slightly different tactic and gave a presentation that I know left a lot of people feeling like they could really power shift the whole situation. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your presentation?
Well, I sensed from the beginning, almost after a couple of the initial talks, that the audience was wanting to know, what do we do now? Because the information was so good and so specific, and one talk after another painted a very clear picture of where we are, in the sense that, there is a covert civilization that is running the society that we see around us. And so naturally what people picked up on was, okay, so where do we go from here? What do we do? What can we possibly do against this? And so you know, I began thinking about how I was going to structure my talk or restructure it in light of realizing that. And so I began with the idea, well, if you're asking the question, what do I do now, to whom are you asking it, really? I mean, there could be more than one target, you know, sure. But ultimately, to whom are you addressing that question? And really, that's a question that people are addressing to themselves.
Right.
So they have to consult with something within themselves to find an answer or answers to that question. And so I began to see, as, you know, all three of us did, that this would become a very fertile subject for another kind of event, a different kind of event, which is what we're talking about now.
There were a couple things. One of my favorite moments at the conference, in fact, wasn't at the conference. It was after the conference was over. And after you'd given your speech, I ran into a friend who had this incredible smile on his face. And I said, what are you thinking about? And he said, I'm figuring out my next big thing. Big thing being something that John had referred to about, you know, don't, the sky's the limit. Think about your next big thing. And, you know, he was clearly pretty inspired. It was, I hadn't seen him look that good for a long time. So it was great. But one of the things I got also that happened was Joel Garbon, who's the head of the New Energy Movement, who's really a remarkable fellow, was there on Sunday when we all spoke. And there was nothing that we said, I think, that Joel doesn't already know. And I contacted him afterwards and he said, you know, it was really a life-changing event for me. And I said, well, why is that? Because there was nothing really new in terms of information for you. And he said, no, it was a matter of seeing all the presentations lined up with no disinformation and no entertainment and no silly business. And this was very much the bar that Joseph, you had insisted we set.
Right.
And, you know, I'm almost thinking that it set a new standard in open source scholarship. But I think when you have something that's at that quality, then it can really start to shift people's feeling of what they're a part of. Mm. So let me just bring up the question of, Joseph, the role of helping people understand not just what's happening today, but history. Because I think part of the power of that day was the way that you brought in the history.
Well, we live in a culture, Catherine, where, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a former college professor. Some people may not know that. But I ran into this phenomenon very, very, very early on. And that is, we live in a culture where the media, where quackademia, as I sometimes like to call it, has basically cut us off from history. They've concocted a historical narrative and taught people to look at it a certain way, particularly in this country. The idea that people band together to make common purpose to achieve social or cultural or political goals has been all but drummed out of you by the time you reach college. You know, the standard American cultural response, particularly in academia, to the idea of conspiracies actually being something that drive history or drive historical events has all but been read out of the curriculum. And of course, we know from recent events in our history that this simply isn't true. So for me, one of the defining things that we have to understand is we have to have a historical perspective on what really moves human history, and that's conspiracy. And if we stop and look at it, conspiracy doesn't necessarily mean or imply something bad or evil in intention or method. What conspiracy simply means is that people breathe or move together to achieve some sort of common purpose. So in other words, almost all human activity in history is a conspiracy of some sort. Some are very highly organized and even recognized in our law, like corporations. Some, of course, have been for very evil purposes and for things that probably all three of us would find highly counterproductive. But but this is a social fact. This is a fact of human nature. And so my approach to this has always been kind of quasi-historical. But first of all, we have to remember where we've been. And then secondly, what can we learn from those types of organizations, both the good ones and the bad ones? What did they do that made them successful? How did they organize themselves? How did they establish communications? And most importantly, I think probably for most people that attended that conference in San Mateo and for your listeners, most importantly, how do we learn to vet sources of information? And how do we learn to vet whom we can trust to make some sort of common cause and purpose to bring back a stable and peaceful society with institutions that are ethical and trustworthy? So those are the big questions for me, and I think history has an important part to play in how we address those questions.
Right, including proving that people have done it before under even more dire circumstances than we're facing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, culture, one of your points to me on many occasions has been we can't really address money or financial system or different kinds of institutions until we address culture. Right. Because ultimately, culture is basically the set of values that we covenant with each other to live by, and without that, there can be no trust.
I took the tack in the little presentation that I made for this workshop. I took the tack that let's look at two individuals in history that had very, very different goals and very different kinds of organizational conspiracy, if you will, that were behind them. And it's very clear that one of the ways we have to begin to think is in terms of identifying people that share our values. In other words, that people that are already implicitly part of some social covenant with us, although we may not know who they are. So in other words, the first thing we have to do is we have to identify. We have to be very specific. This isn't simply an intuitive thing. If necessary, we have to go to the point of writing down and drawing up very specific lists of our own personal hierarchy of values, what our future vision is, what our goals are, what we would like to see happen in 5, 10, 15 years, and so on. And once we get an idea of that, then we're in a position to start looking at the people that we want to associate with and the information sources we want to turn to bring that about.
One of the things I didn't understand until I got sort of thrown overboard by the powers that be is how, you know, I was trained that we just, you know, whatever we needed, we just invent, you know, or we just buy, or we just, you know, but then we believed absolutely we were perfectly capable of inventing and creating our world. And so it was to my shock and amazement, I discovered that that was somehow considered to be impossible or illegal. And anyway, so it took many years, but I came to the realization that the greatest thing that protects the status quo is the inability of the general population to imagine alternatives or imagine that we have the power to get together and invent whatever we want, you know, including a whole new way of doing things. And so that's when I came upon John Rappaport's work. So John, I wanted you to talk a little bit about all the amazing things you've done with imagination and how imagination fits in. You know, history is a great inspirer because it shows us what other people have done and how they've done it. But ultimately, we have to each imagine our own pathway and then organize together. So talk to us a little bit about imagination and what you're going to be talking about on November 8th.
Well, I think we could start with this and in line with what Joseph was talking about. History, one of the things that history shows us is that reality is invented for the public, the mass, society, by people who are conspiring to do so. And they take it very seriously. This isn't just a small piecemeal operation. There have been groups, organizations down through history who have made it their business to say, we're going to create a very convincing reality about what life is, about what its limits are, about what principles pertain, about what perception should feed back to people, etc., etc., and yet try to conceal that this is what we're doing, that we are imagining it and we are imposing it. We want people to believe that this is real, A, and B, the only reality, and that it's very natural, and that they've come upon it in a natural way, and it's part of what you discover in life, and there is no way around it. Whereas, in truth, we, the conspirators, are perverse artists, and we are imagining and creating this whole reality for everybody else, but we don't want to let that cat out of the bag. So a great deal of my work has been to show people the nuts and bolts of how this is done, how behind the scenes this stage play called reality is built, so that people get a sense and a flavor and a almost a sensory feeling about it. Oh, so this is how it's done. This is the way it works. Because then, by extension, people will understand, well, if they can do it for us and for me, I can do it for myself.
Right.
That's the natural conclusion to reach. And so that is a major starting point for what imagination is all about, and how people have been hypnotized over a very long period of time, and cultures have been hypnotized and societies and so forth into thinking that this way out does not exist at all, that there is no such thing really as imagination, or that it's just a toy for children, a plaything, and when one reaches, you know, adulthood, you throw that aside and you become very practical and adjust and fit in and so forth and so on, when this is not the case at all.
Well, it's interesting. There are certain traps, because, you know, a lot of my work is on the practical nuts and bolts of all of this. And one of the reasons I'm so adamant that it helps to understand what's going on is that's what you need to see, how it interweaves with the practical nuts and bolts. And that was, John, always my reason for loving many of your interviews, because you bring it down to, you know, how does it work at the nursing station, and what does the doctor do, and how does that connect with all of this? But one of the first shocks that I received was I suddenly realized, I went out when I first started to go public and do speaking tours, and I realized, wait a minute, everyone I'm speaking to is taking their opinion of other people from a media representing the people who are trying to kill them. Now, right. If you're trying to kill me, but I allow you to determine who I think is a winner and who I think is a loser and who I think is a good guy and who is a bad guy, then it's fair to say I'm not going to make it.
I think you could predict that, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of this is, if we're going to navigate, then we need a way to understand the world around us. And that starts with, as Joseph said, getting reliable sources of information, which is, of course, how I found you guys, looking for reliable sources of information. But, you know, part of it is literally removing the addiction that is present in the body politic for untrustworthy sources of information or untrustworthy associations or dependency. You know, for example, a lot of my work is dependency on untrustworthy financial institutions. You know, our whole lives are intertwined in a very practical way with the very people and institutions we'd like to get away from. And so there's a, you know, it's the practicality of doing this is pretty tricky.
Yep. No. Information and perception are some of the key things that I think that all three of us are intending to address at this workshop, because perception is the basis of how we act. And, excuse me, that in turn is based on the information that's made available to us, and then how we synthesize it. And even the act of synthesis has been so poisoned by the various media outlets, television, newspapers, some of the internet sources, academia, and so on, that my own approach has always been you compare sources carefully. In other words, you have to start taking responsibility for your own information, and that's a key thing that I found both during teaching, challenging people to trust their mind, their own mind, and to question the textbook or to question the professor. And let me give you an example. Let me give you a story that I think will help illustrate this, Catherine, possibly for your listeners. I'm an old-fashioned professor. I'm very old school. I don't believe in these fill in the blank with your number two lead pencil standardized tests at all. So most of my tests in college were essay tests. You know, I read their writing. They were graded on not only what they wrote, but how they wrote it. And, you know, that made me terribly unpopular because we're used to the prefabricated answers. You know, we can envision a standardized test, an SAT or something like this, with the question, who killed John Kennedy? And four answers, A, B, C, D, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, you know, some fake answers. But none of them are going to tell you answer E, a conspiracy of mutual interests of different factions involving Cubans, mafia, intelligence, you know, we get
right. The picture.
So one day after one of my notorious essay exams, my students in a history class just begged and pleaded and insisted with me that I give them a multiple choice question type of test. So I did. I came up with a test, and it had 26 different answers to choose from. The test was only one question. And the 26 different multiple choices were all wrong. They were all very subtly differently worded from each other. So, you know, I handed this thing out, and I'm looking at the students, and they've got their heads down. There's a few moans and groans and sighs and squirms, you know. And one student, after the test was done, he came up and he handed in his paper and he says, Dr. Farrell, can I see you outside in the class? Outside. And I said, sure. And so we went outside and he said, I really had difficulty finishing this. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, I really thought about the answers and none of them were correct. And I said, well, congratulations, you get the A. And This is the problem. We have to first of all start learning to trust our own mind. Just because somebody has a PhD behind their name or is standing in front of a classroom or doing a PowerPoint presentation doesn't make them right or an expert. All it means is that people have been so conditioned to think that, well, their answers or their insights have to be wrong, and therefore, you know, we have to play the game. As John puts it in his many talks, you know, this is part of the matrix reality that's being created around people. So we have to change this idea that we're passive before information. We have to start becoming responsible for the information that we turn to and for the sources that we turn to. And then realize that we are responsible for our own synthesis and action upon our perceptions.
You know, one of the things I realized that I hadn't realized when I was listening to the presentations in San Mateo is that I'd come to think of scholars as people who are used to herd me, control me, or try and gaslight me into the official reality. And I'd forgotten that scholars are people who can make me powerful and support me and lift me up. And it was like, wow, you know, Western civilization is back. This is great. Yeah,
exactly. This to me is one of the key defining things. If people feel helpless before a flow of information, there's probably something wrong with the flow of information.
So I just have to talk about two things that happened there that were my favorite moments, because they go to the heart of some of the things we're going to talk about. And I'm hoping you guys remember them, because I'm going to ask you to tell about them. But the first was John Rappaport, when a guy got up and from the audience and said, "Now, what are we going to do?" And John went off, as you know, in the beautiful way that only he can do. Do you remember what it was, John?
I don't.
You basically said to him, "What do you mean, we?"
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then you pointed at me and said, "You thought that was easy? That took years for her to figure out." He said, and then you said, "What are you going to do?"
Right.
But it was back to the individual and personal responsibility and each one of us inventing our pathway and our contribution.
Yeah, and just to comment on what Joseph just said, the information that's being invented for us, you know, the false reality, is really designed to make us feel helpless. I mean,
right.
The purpose of it, you know, is to corral people into a certain kind of space where there are no exit signs. There's no way out. One is utterly convinced, well, this is it.
Curtis Mayfield has the...
Well, the only thing I can do is to figure out how I fit into this big it, because this is the only it there is. And, of course, it's all false, and it's all built as a closed system, which feeds into itself in various ways. And so just think about what that does to a person's own sense of imagination. Well, that's the first thing that they're going to throw overboard, because imagination as a quality is that faculty that every person has that, among other things, allows him or her to exit and get outside any reality and instead build one of their own.
Right.
So if all the information sources are designed to make people feel, well, this is my life, it's rather limited, fenced in, small, I have limited roles to play here, so I better figure out how to fit in, then imagination is not going to be any part of that, and hence there are not going to be any exits. So when that person said, "What are we going to do?" essentially they were admitting, well, I'm trapped. I'm trapped in this false reality of deceptive information that is making me believe that I exist in this space and this space only, and there's nowhere else to go.
Curtis Mayfield has a wonderful album called New World Order that he produced in 1989, and one of the songs it says, "One way in and no way out."
Right.
So the other thing that happened at the panel was one very wonderful Salir Report subscriber got up and asked us what we thought was what we thought of the goddess culture, and I could, if I had to, I could write a book and do an entire course on how to play women and men against each other. I've been watching it my whole life, because I think that's the number one divide and conquer game. If you could heal that divide and conquer game, you could heal all the others very easily. But anyway, so I kind of said, you know, I don't buy that, don't fall for that, you know, blah blah blah. But then Richard Dolan went off. So you can see he suffered that one. And then Joseph, you jumped in, and the two of you did like a duet on the whole topic. I was crying. I was laughing so hard. So maybe, Joseph, if you could talk a little bit about the divide and conquer game, because to me that's another very dangerous.
That's, like you say, that's the oldest game in the book. Divide men from women.
Right.
Divide age groups. You know, I come out of an education system, and probably the you two do as well, where we're divided and conquered from elementary school. We're
right.
Slotted, you know, we're slotted into these ridiculous age divisions, first grade, second grade, third grade. And then by the time you get to middle school or junior high school, they add to this divide and conquer routine that you're slotted into this class for 50 minutes and then you run for 3 minutes to the next class and you sit down and you barely start being able to make progress in a certain discipline, be it spelling or social studies or what have you, and then the bell rings and off you go to the next class. So they keep everything deliberately divided, and it makes you, you know, this is the matrix reality that John has been talking about so many times, because we're taught to think that, well, we can't survive without this education system. Well, you know, by golly, yes we can. You know, the old country one-room schoolhouse performed very well. It mixed people and children of different ages in the same room. It allowed the teacher to teach. And when we get right down to it, you know, we think of all the famous people that have contributed to Western civilization, Socrates, Da Vinci, Aquinas, Kant, Newton, and on, all these people never went to an American public school. They never took an American standardized test from a certified teacher from a state certified teaching college. So in other words, this is another form of reality. This is the old divide and conquer game, and it's everywhere that you look. And what it does is it prevents you, just like John says, from having your own individuality, your own individual imagination, and most importantly, your own individual personality. We are collectivized and slotted and categorized and labeled and numbered, and that's the matrix reality. And to realize that you're not powerless and that you are responsible for your own information, your own synthesis of that information, your own perceptions, and your own actions, that's an extraordinarily liberating moment. I've literally stood in front of classrooms when I was a professor and seen the light bulb go off on students' faces.
Isn't that an exciting moment?
It is a very exciting moment because you know, it makes it worthwhile. So the divide and conquer game, Catherine, it's everywhere around us. You know, we could do seminars, semester-long seminars.
How to beat the divide and conquer. I was, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, there are false divisions. This is fundamentally what I think people have to understand. These divisions are false. They're false dialectics. I have nothing against dialectics, but there's good dialectics and there's bad dialectics. And these are a particularly specious form of it. And once people realize that, you know, this balkanization of American society, you know, we've got the hyphenated American now, black Americans, white Americans, old Americans, young Americans. Well, this is the other problem. This is all balkanization, because what it's really saying is you're not an individual. You're not a person.
All right. They're trying to do the same thing to you and me that they're doing to the Ukraine or to Russia. They're trying to balkanize everything.
Yes, exactly.
It's funny. I needed Jan Rappaport with me the other day because I was talking to a mathematician. I was trying to bring him down. He was in a state of complete apoplexy, and I was trying to help calm him down. He had gone to his kid's school it was back to school time, and he was getting an introduction to their new math curriculum. This is Common Core. And remember, now you've got a mathematician in the South. And they introduce him to I guess it was an algebra problem. And the message was that the kids were supposed to work together to get the solution. And it wasn't important if they got it right. What was important, they worked well together. And he was looking, he said, math is very simple. If you get it right, it's right. If you get it wrong, and it's no good if it's wrong. And I said, well, don't you know that if your family is killed driving across the bridge made by the engineers who couldn't do math, you will die happy knowing that they had a very positive collaborative experience. And I thought, now this is the complete absence of Western civilization, but well packaged.
Well
packaged, exactly.
I did some reading recently because this phrase kept popping up in some articles I was reading, cooperative learning, to discover that not only is this now being promoted in schools everywhere, but there's now like a meta academic discipline, which is writing about and researching cooperative learning. So it's sprouting various cancerous tumors as it goes. And again, as you say, the whole point they emphasize is the process of sitting there with several other students and working on something and, oh, but now we have to divide up the tasks, and this will develop tolerance, and the slow people and the fast people. And
so, John, how many vaccines does it take to make a classroom good at cooperative learning?
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, there's divide and conquer, and then there's globify and conquer.
Right.
Where everything becomes, you know, one giant glob of melted down cheese where all the people
connect
are considered to not be individuals at all, but you only exist because we say you're part of a group.
Right.
And so to enforce this, we're going to use this filter by which you get all the information in your education through cooperative learning. And again, the idea of the individual is completely eradicated and stifled and so forth. So when people come out of that system, all they can do is look around for other people to attach themselves to, because that's the fundamental lesson that they've learned in their education.
So
let me chime in on that one. I couldn't agree.
Please do.
When I was a professor, this became one of my mantras. You know, I was constantly, in fact, I even taught a class once in philosophical ethics, and it was aimed toward businessmen. Most of the people in that class were coming out of a business background, and they were subjected to various management theory textbooks, you know, whole person management and all of this claptrap, team players and all this win-win solutions. And I pointed out to them that these are all groupthink. These are all to homogenize you and globify, as John aptly calls it, globify you into some particular mass that's to accomplish something. And I said, let's stop and ask ourselves, Did Verdi compose his operas as a team effort? Did Velazquez paint his paintings as a group effort? Did Leonardo work in a group? Did Newton? Did Einstein? Did Leibniz? Did René Descartes? Did any of these people work in a group? Well, no, they didn't. They put their ideas out there and claimed the academic right to be wrong. And this is the other thing we have to overcome. We have to overcome this constant globify mentality and take responsibility back and claim our right to be wrong. And people are afraid of that because no one likes to be wrong. But, you know, the fundamental fact of any information processing that any of us as individuals do is we're going to be wrong at some point. But that doesn't abrogate the responsibility to do so. I couldn't agree with you more, John. I'm so sick and tired of hearing about cooperative education and all this nonsense. It's not even funny.
See, I'm very lucky. I live in the South, and we value eccentricity.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is my experience, Catherine. This is, you know, from my own personal background. I know John and you have been through similar things. This was my reason for doing my doctorate at Oxford, because I, by the time I entered various PhD programs in this country, I left them all because I was still being told I had to go to X number of general education courses. I had to listen to some droning professor calling a book report a lecture, which it isn't.
And right.
I still had to get my name ticked off in a roll call book, just like I was in kindergarten.
Right.
Fulfill X number of credit hours. Over in Oxford, I was thrown into the deep end of the pool, and trust me, over there, everybody.
Well, but my impression of your, from what I've heard about your education in Oxford and others, is you were really expected to come up with original research and results. It's like, okay, well, what's your original contribution going to be?
Yeah, the academic standard there, and it's the old, you know, it used to be the prevailing standard in universities throughout the West, and I'm sure that things are probably changing for the worse over there. But the two standards, Catherine, were you either come up with an original synthesis of old data, or you come up with new data and then seek to synthesize that into the body of whatever discipline it is that you're dealing with. So, you know, it's expected of you, there's, you know, there's no course structure there. You're not required to attend one course. The only thing you have to get through is the exam at the end of it.
Well, you know, I'll never forget when I grew up as a child, I spent a lot of time with my mother's father, my maternal grandfather. And, you know, the dinner conversation was always, okay, well, what are you going to contribute to Western civilization? Well, here's what this ancestor did, and here's what that person did, and this guy messed up, and, well, what are you going to do? You know, and it was always, well, what are you going to do? If the car needed fixing, well, are you going to go out and figure out how to fix a car, or, you know, what are you going to do? And it was interesting because my father was, he came back from World War II. He'd been in a MASH unit in Burma during World War II. And he came back, took one look at the emergency medicine system in this country and completely reinvented it and got it adopted across the country and in a way that saved lives. And my other, his brother, half-brother, went out and developed the first transplant, kidney transplant facility in South Carolina. Their father had been the guy who introduced penicillin to Tennessee. And, you know, all they ever talked about was, well, you know, it was a competition to see who could make the biggest, most power shifting contribution to advance our civilization. And if you had said to any one of them, well, how much money did you make last year? They would have looked at you like, what's your problem? You know, it's like, are you from Miceville or what?
Exactly.
And, you know, I was having dinner with somebody who had known them, I don't know, about a year ago, and it brought it back to me, and I realized, how did things ever get this bad?
John says something that, with the emphasis that we have to use imagination, and we have to step inside this matrix reality. And part of that is, it has, I believe very strongly, an inevitable component of social responsibility. And I used to illustrate this with my students by asking them, when was the last time you heard a Democrat or a Republican use the phrase the public welfare or the good of the people?
I don't remember.
What they always talk about is the good of America. And usually by that, the implication is the good of the elite. The good of the nation, the good of the government. So, in other words, we've all but lost that public discourse of social responsibility. And social responsibility, cultural responsibility, that's a very different thing than the globification.
Because, right.
Because the ultimate ground of any kind of social responsibility like that is, as you say, it's a covenant, it's a contract, and for that to occur, you have to have some hierarchy of shared values.
Right.
And this again, I mean, this, we're back to basic civilization 101. How are we going to go about achieving that? And I think we've absolutely got to step out of the matrix, use our imagination, and get out of this blobification mode.
One of the things when we started to work on this together, I sat down, I took a working vacation in August, and I said, I need to come up with a new vision of my inspired and free life. And all I could think of were obstacles. And I said, you know, in fact, what I need to spend some time doing at this event is getting inspiration about blowing by the obstacles. And the one thing I've heard from all the Solari Report subscribers is their number one obstacle is having people in their lives, including very close family, who don't want to blow out of the matrix structure. And I think for me, the biggest challenge was learning to love people, but let them go and say, look, I'm blowing out. So I love you. You know, I'll see you at Christmas every year, but that's it. I'm out. You know, I'm moving on. And to me, it's a lot of the biggest questions are, how do I deal with people in my life who, you know, embrace the matrix or don't want to leave it or are naive or brainwashed or, you know, it goes on and on and on. But I know that's a very big obstacle. And I was going to ask you what you thought were some of the big obstacles that we're going to probably end up talking about.
Well, I think that is a huge one that you've mm-hmm. just mentioned. And I think everybody who will be there has experienced it in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
When you break out, you realize that what you've been accepting as the truth is not really the truth, and that you have to fall back on your own resources and begin to live a much more independent kind of life. And then you see that the people around you or a particular person, does not seem to understand what that means. If they do, they don't want that. They don't want you to do that. They feel threatened, afraid. They feel that you've broken the covenant established with them, because at one time, your relationship with that person seemed to be all about A, B, C, D, and F that was shared. And now you're into RSTUV, you know, way down the line somewhere. And they're thinking, well, what is this all about? You know, and I don't like it. It's not good. It's a threat. You've become very strange, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is that can be the biggest obstacle for a person, how to stand on your own.
Right.
And yet connect with other people who are not.
Right.
You know, and how do you connect? When do you connect? On what basis do you connect? And one of the things that helped me a great deal, because I reached several of those crises along the way in earlier years, was to begin to see that this whole kind of matrix-like network of people acting with each other in certain prescribed ways was a piece of theater. Mm-hmm. It was really a theatrical presentation that they had all signed on to. Whether they were participating in it, and there were roles, uh-huh. and scripts and lines to deliver, uh-huh. and places to laugh and places to say this and that and so forth and so on. And at that point, it occurred to me, well, if I want to for 15 minutes or a half hour or 3 hours or whatever it is, I can sign up for this play, you know, one night only for me. For others, it could be 50 years, but there's an option there, you know.
Right.
Okay, here I am in this situation. To some extent, I can see, you know, it's not, when looked at from that angle, it's not totally repulsive. It can be kind of interesting on a very limited basis, and I can become an actor in that play, but I can also leave the play, and would, and do. And it's that in and out and in and out capacity, to me, that makes life tolerable when you've actually, you know, broken through and broken.
Right. Right. I remember my greatest moment was when I realized I could read any mainstream press or watch any mainstream TV news and read the covert side into it.
Yeah.
So I just want to tell you one of the most interesting things that's happened to me recently is I very much enjoy working with money with the sort of the next generations. And one of the things I've started to see in our subscriber base is people coming to me and saying, you know, I want my kids to understand how things really work because I'm afraid for them. They're going to go out in the marketplace and they're going to compete against the sons and daughters of the Japanese Yakuza, the Chinese Dryads, the Ukraine oligarchs, the Goldman Sachs partners. And those kids are going to have learned from their parents how the world really works.
Right.
And I can't afford for my kids to go listen to 13 years of Common Core and come out and be, you know, targets for those predators. I need them to be able to navigate. And they're beginning to realize that the truth is necessary if their kids are going to make it in a very changed world we're going into.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all again about obstacles and about whom to trust. And
right.
For my part, my experience through long association with various ecclesiastical bodies and so on, and then as a college professor, was I quickly learned that my role was really not to convert everybody to
right.
action or to my particular point of view. What my strategy became was I had to put enough of my vision or my interpretation of things out there as a sort of test template to see who would nibble. So in other words, it's the old military adage, strategic, offensive, tactical, defensive. You take the ground and then sit and wait and watch for what happens. See who attacks you. See who just kind of sits back and doesn't care. See who contacts you and says, oh yes, I've seen a similar thing. And it's those people that one can begin to talk with and see if perhaps there's some basis for further common action. So in other words, we have to get out of the globification mentality again.
Right.
That we have to convert everybody. No, we don't. You know, that's God's job. Bluntly. All we have to do is again, you know, take individual responsibility, claim the academic right to be wrong, and share enough of our views that people will know where we're coming from in whatever circle we're moving, be it, you know, a local school board or what have you. And then let people who share those views contact us. And that becomes the beginning nexus of further contact, further conversation, and hopefully further action down the road. So we don't have to, in a certain sense, we don't have to remove the obstacles. The obstacles, if we learn this strategic, offensive, tactical, defensive technique well enough, the obstacles remove themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
Very important. Well, very important.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why I think
there's there's sort of two states of mind, one in which the obstacles seem to be so many and so overwhelming that
right.
action is impossible. And then there's another state of mind that you were just describing, Joseph, which is not really. You know, if you make
right.
your position known
right.
and sit there and see what happens, as the fallout and who shows up and who doesn't and how they show up and so forth, you begin to see the beginning of a strategy, as you say,
right.
for working in concert with others that is so far superior to just embedding yourself in the mass.
Yeah, what it does is it shines the light on the sociological topography that surrounds you in whatever location or whatever profession or whatever endeavor you're involved with. Doing that sort of thing reveals the structure that's around you. And we have to, bear in mind that we're dealing with a great big huge New World Order pink elephant in the room. But that pink elephant has hairs on the body and feet on the ground in whatever locality we're in. And so what this does is it identifies the implicit players that are part of that structure, and it shines the light on who's kind of sitting on the fence. And it ultimately will reveal the people that are thinking the same sorts of things. So, it's just good old military doctrine. What it really is just a kind of reconnaissance and forcing that structure to reveal itself.
I've seen this so many times as a reporter.
Oh, yeah.
Where I thought I was covering one story. Yeah, and it turns out I'm actually working on something completely different. And I started thinking to myself, well, I'm actually working as a sociologist here on this story.
Yeah, exactly.
In a very real sense, because the players are revealing themselves to me. I'm talking to them. And lo and behold, what they're showing me is that my original starting point has nothing to do with the game that's actually being played here. This
right.
is a completely different game. And those are some of the most illuminating moments, I have to say, especially in the early work that I did as a reporter, where I would set out, okay, this is it, and I'm going to prove this or whatever. And I start talking to people, and I suddenly realize, wait a minute here. This is a territory that is surrounded and infiltrated by players of whom I have absolutely no knowledge. And now that
right.
I'm gaining it, the bigger picture is now emerging, and I can actually deal with it, and I know how to deal with it because I'm piling up authentic experience as opposed to preconceived ideas.
Right. It's to draw an analogy, it's a military operational plan, or it's a business plan or a marketing plan or what have you, that once you do the reconnaissance may reveal the assumptions of the plan are all wrong and changed. And this is the other thing that is very revealing about the historical approach to all of this, is because you see these types of activities constantly in history, where a group or a conspiracy of some sort has some sort of plan, but it encounters some sort of obstacle, so it adjusts the plan. It responds to the actual circumstances of their reconnaissance, and this is crucial. This is, I hate to put it in these callously military or intelligence operations terms, but this is the way people have to start thinking and acting. Flexibility is always crucial, like you say. And I've had the same experience. I start out to write a book, and I have a certain preconceived notion of where it's going to go, and I start researching, and all of a sudden I'm discovering I'm in a completely different world. What I imagined was there,
Well, let me turn to the event. I just want to make sure we cover some of the details for people. We're going to be sending invitations to subscribers who are in the area and who've asked to be included in the invitation list, and that mailing will go out on September 17th. So if you're listening to this after September 17th and you would like an invitation, please just let us know at customer service or member@solaria.com, and we'd be delighted to send you an invitation. If we're looking to fill 35 slots, it's going to be very small. It will not be recorded. We will do a report afterwards for subscribers and the members of Joseph's site and the people that John invites. It'll just be sort of our private membership groups. But again, if you're interested, let us know and we'll send you a mailing. We're going to be meeting. We're going to start in the morning on Saturday, November 8th, and go from 8:30 to 6:30. We'll provide breakfast and lunch. And then everyone attending is invited to join us the following day. We're a great believer that a good night's sleep will let things sort of percolate, and we'll see what emerge. And we're going to have a non-hosted brunch. It's pay yourself. At the Creekside Inn, which is very close to Allied Arts, where we'll be having it in Menlo Park. And so we've got a great group in the Bay Area, and we're hoping some of them will come. So there's a lot of connectivity, and hopefully a lot of people who either attended the Secret Space Program Conference or have watched the stream. So again, let us know if you're interested in getting an invitation, because we'd love to have you. And we're hoping, if this is successful, that this is the beginning of a conversation that we can take to other places, including into the heartland of the country. So John or Joseph, would you like to add anything about that day and what we hope to get accomplished?
No, I think I've spelled it out as far as I can, and I'd like to hear what Joseph has to say.
Well, I'm fully on board with the two of you and with the people at the San Mateo conference. I'm hoping that we can begin a conversation and begin to create some critical mass and a discussion on what each of us can do and how we can network and so on and so forth. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay. Well.
Me too.
John, Joseph, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Solaria Report.
Thanks for having us.
Great.
Bye.
Bye-bye.